Rosa Cortez versus Zachary Wyash. May it please the court, Mr. Barry Johnson will represent the appellant and Mr. Ruben Rios will represent the appellee.
Mr. Johnson.
May it please the court.
It is a great pleasure to be here at Texas Wesleyan. I remember when I was in law school many years ago, we had the opportunity to go witness the Supreme Court in a final argument. And I don't remember much about the case, but one of the counsel used some empty milk cartons as a demonstrative exhibit, and I think he was trying to show that they were sort of set up in a pyramid, and it was, the whole argument fell, and he knocked the cartons away, they flew across the courtroom, and he was mildly chastised by the court of presiding judge for not using demonstrative evidence in court. It's been over 30 years. I still remember that demonstrative evidence works, I guess. This case presents an issue of whether or not the trial court erred in sustaining the appellee's objection to the use of Mr. Wyash's prior felony convictions. And the standard that this court will use, of course, is abuse of discretion in whether or not the trial court erred. As the many articles and opinions have said, all evidence is generally prejudicial to one side or the other. Now, this is a motor vehicle accident case which occurred at 3 a.m. and my client, Ms. Cortez, testified that she was waiting to make a left turn yielding to oncoming traffic when she was rear-ended by Mr. Wyash. Mr. Wyash testified that my client did not have her lights on, was not signaling. He came over a rise and suddenly had sort of a sudden emergency and couldn't stop, and that's why he hit her. And a take-nothing verdict and judgment were rendered. The liability in this case turned on who the jury believed. It was literally a he said, she said case. The appellant, we tried to impeach Mr. Wyash using his three prior felony convictions. He had two convictions for evading arrest and also had two that were enhanced with two prior felony convictions, and one conviction for theft, a felony conviction for theft. The trial court sought to weigh the probative value and the prejudicial effect and excluded the evidence. We contend that this was an abuse of discretion.
Do you think there's a distinction between the exclusion of the theft offense and the other offenses?
Yes, I mean, I think clearly the theft, I think the argument for it being the theft offense was stronger. It's a crime of moral turpitude, but not by very much, I don't think, because evading arrest is the type of offense that shows disrespect for law enforcement. It's the type of offense that bears on how seriously the witness will take the oath that he's sworn to uphold by telling the truth. And so,
you want to run that by me again?
Evading
arrest is related to telling the truth?
I believe it is. As far as respect for law enforcement, and he had two cases for evading arrest. Now, evading arrest has been held not to be a crime of moral turpitude, and I've looked at that, and I'm sure the court has many times about exactly what moral turpitude encompasses. Of course, historically, the federal rules concerning the exclusion, the use of felony convictions, we cited in our brief the fact that when the Congress was considering it, and the committee that I don't understand all the how all that works when it gets submitted, but the committee considering it basically just dismissed the idea that in a civil case, significant prejudice from a felony conviction would be even something to worry about. They were most concerned, I think, about a person accused of a crime going to trial, whether or not his or her prior felony conviction should be admissible, because that's the criminal defendant obviously faces a difficult decision about whether or not to testify. The downside being, if that defendant testifies, his or her past comes in, including prior felony convictions. Whereas in civil cases, the stakes are lower. I mean, there are money damages, but compared to incarceration, the death penalty, they're much lower as far as the stake, what is at stake in a civil case.
While we're talking about civil cases, on page 15 of your brief, you sort of smooth by the relationship between the past crime and the present crime because of the civil case. Well, I can see where there's criminal cases, for example, involving fraud or maybe credit card theft or something that directly involve lying, whereas evading arrest, lying?
That is true, Justice. With respect to the difference, I mean, most of the cases seem to say that if it's directly a very similar type of case, that would be a reason to exclude it. If it was a crime of speeding, for example, that's probably not a good example, but maybe alcohol drinking, DWI. If a person had prior convictions for DWI, then it would be prejudicial to say, well, he always is drinking and driving because of his prior conviction. That might be a reason to exclude it. Now, in this case, the fact that the evading arrest is not as culpable or truth involving as theft, I would say, but it so happens the theft case that's in the record concerns theft of a vehicle, and the evading arrest, the two offenses for evading arrest, are related obviously to vehicles as well.
That doesn't have anything to do with causing a car wreck, though, does it? I mean, is that really an argument?
No, the argument is not that this has anything to do with the fact that he was driving and when all this other stuff happened, doesn't have anything to do with it. What's important is that he was convicted of three felonies.
But so you want the jury to hear that, so they will be prejudiced against him because he is a convicted felon. And your client is just this girl that was out driving and got hit. I mean, that's really the bottom line. That's what you want the jury to be prejudiced against him based upon those convictions.
Well,
is it not?
In the same sense that I want them to be prejudiced against him for not telling the truth. That type of prejudice. Not because these are garden variety, I hate to use that term, but garden variety criminal offenses. Not the type that cause extreme prejudice, such as, you know, a child molestation or a drug person making deliveries of drugs. These are cases that immediately turn a jury against a person. That is a bad person who is doing these type of offenses.
And a repeat felony offender is not going to be considered by the jury to be a bad person and prejudice against him for that?
Well, as I believe all evidence can be prejudicial against a person, but does it make it more likely, or is it easier for the jury to evaluate Mr. Wash's truth-telling and likelihood to tell the truth?
Well, what you were trying to impeach him on, at least according to your brief, was that he told varying stories about whether your client had passed him prior to the collision. What difference does that possibly make in the liability question in this case, whether she passed him prior to the actual collision occurring? That has nothing to do with Mr. Weiss's liability, does it?
No, but it bears on his credibility, I believe. The trial court took pains to inquire about whether or not there were prior inconsistent statements that would make these convictions more relevant or admissible.
But he admitted to the prior inconsistent statements. He admitted that he was confused, and he admitted to the jury that, in fact, she wasn't the person who had passed him prior to the collision occurring. So once somebody admits to that, you can't prove it up by independent means and independent evidence, so why should you be able to impeach him on it?
Well, of course, he used it as the significant phrase in his deposition was, that story was out the window. At some point, he realized or claimed that he realized that Ms. Cortez was not the person who had been driving recklessly and passed him on the roadway. So he dropped that line of defense when questioned by the police.
But it's not a line of defense. Well, it's not a defense in any way, shape, or form.
No, but it's, if it was true, if it had been true that Ms. Cortez was driving recklessly prior to the accident, it might make it, the jury might think it more likely that she was continuing to behave dangerously by not having her lights on or not signaling her turn.
It's almost like you're trying to impeach him on a collateral matter. Whether she passed him or not has nothing to do with the facts of the accident.
Well, it is somewhat collateral. I mean, the story he told to the police, though, I mean, is that a collateral matter or is that part of the investigation and whether or not he's telling the truth when this accident is being investigated?
The police officer never put that in his report or said it had anything to do, and the police officer found that Mr. Weish was responsible at fault for the accident. So, I mean, you had everything before the jury that you needed. You had him admitting he made inconsistent statements, him admitting saying that story's out the window, the police officer saying it was Mr. Weish's fault. You had everything lined up. Why do you need those very prejudicial felony convictions under those circumstances?
The jury apparently believed Mr. Weish when he said that Ms. Cortez did not have her turn signal on and did not have her lights on. So if the jury had known that he has had convictions for theft and had convictions for evading arrest, would that help the jury to evaluate Mr. Weish's credibility? I believe under this record that it would have helped the jury to evaluate Mr. Weish. The trial court, even involving the ticket that was Mr. Weish had initially denied that he had pleaded guilty, and he did, said he didn't recall whether or not he had pleaded no contest to the falling too closely offense that he had been given a ticket for. And when we presented, this was a hearing outside the presence of the jury where we had a copy of the conviction, where we showed that he had pleaded guilty to falling too closely and had been, in fact, sentenced to 3 days in jail. And Judge Cosby was, I think, bent over backwards to protect Mr. Weish in an attempt to be fair, very fair to him. But I think he went too far in protecting him. Judge Cosby, on the record, did not want the jury to know that his sentence included, I think, 3 days in jail or something like that. But that was just a fact of, apparently, that Mr. Weish had ignored the ticket or had not received it in the mail or something and had a warrant and eventually been sentenced to jail. But
if you could, for a few minutes, just address harm, because even assuming that the trial court did abuse its discretion in refusing to allow the admission of these offenses the evidence for your use on cross-examination. How can you establish harm in light of the fact that the police officer testified that Mr. Weish received the ticket for following too closely and was in fact the cause of the accident? In other words, that seems more probative evidence of the cause of the accident supporting Mrs. Cortez's view than any possible cross-examination on these offenses could play.
Well, under the facts as presented, the ticket that was given to Mr. Weish was for falling too closely. And as a practical matter, there was not any evidence that he followed too closely. Cortez had not seen him following behind, and Mr. Weish denied that he had been following too closely, and his story was that he came upon her when she was stopped after coming up on a ride. So the offense for which he was convicted did not really fit the facts of the case. So even though the police had given him a ticket, it really did not, for that offense, did not really fit into anybody's theory about what happened in the accident. So because of that, whether or not Mr. Weish was telling the truth about what happened, coming over their eyes, that was really what was at issue. And if the jury had known about the prior conviction, we believe it would have made a difference in the verdict.
Mr. Reyes?
May it please the court, counsel. I think the court focused on the issues that we attempted to focus on in our brief. In connection with these felony convictions, the fact is there was ample evidence presented to the jury to where there was no need or necessity for this information. The officer testified despite stringent objections to his qualifications and came in and talked about liability and causation. The citation that he issued for following too closely in a plea of guilty was also allowed to be entered into evidence before a jury. The jury heard that. They didn't hear whether Mr. Weiss thought he had pled no contest. What they heard was Mr. Weiss on the stand saying, I got a ticket for following too closely and I pled guilty. You also had Ms. Cortez. You also had, through the officer, testimony that the passengers, the two passengers in Ms. Cortez's vehicle, felt the impact from the back first, then the impact from the front. So you had photographs of the vehicles that were also admitted into evidence. So you had a sufficient amount of evidence for the jury to consider, based on the facts and totality of the circumstances, the issues of liability and causation. I think Judge Cosby was clear when he started doing his balancing tests in connection with this case. One of the things that was interesting is he immediately talked about he did not think the purpose or intent of allowing prior convictions was just to throw it out there in hopes of winning the case. That clearly seemed to be the issue in this instance. He was also concerned with the fact that the word insurance had been thrown about in the court prior to or during the trial. He mentioned that aspect as well. As the court is aware, there's ample case law that says the court can look at the totality of the circumstances, the evidence, when making a decision to include or exclude evidence. I believe Judge Cosby was doing that, and he did it on the record verbally for everyone to know what his thought process was.
Well, let me ask you this. You put in your brief that part of the court's reasoning for keeping the criminal convictions out was throwing the word insurance around, and you cited, and of course, we actually do read the record, so I'm not connecting the two thoughts, insurance and criminal convictions.
Well, I think the problem is with civil cases, it's always there's a great effort to try to avoid utilizing the word insurance, because obviously, as the court is aware, the jury starts determining somebody has money that the insurance company is going to pay, and it's not going to be, in this case, Mr. Weiss, then why do they care if they find him liable? The court obviously had some concerns that there may have already been some prejudice towards Mr. Weiss with regards to the insurance information already being thrown out there. When you talk about insurance, I believe Judge Cosby was concerned about the prejudicial effect that that may have on the defendant, and was one of his considerations as to why he didn't allow the felony convictions to come in and to actually heap on additional prejudice on Mr. Weiss. Now, he also talked about the fact that this was limited for impeachment only. He got that up front and clear from counsel for Ms. Cortez. And when they talked about the impeachment evidence, as the court has alluded to, there was nothing to establish, number one, that Mr. Weiss actually made the statement. Now, his testimony was he probably said it, he wasn't sure, and he was confused. The officer never said he heard it. The officer never acknowledged that that statement was made, and I think it was made clear that it didn't factor into his decision-making, and it wasn't referenced in the police report, which went completely against Mr. Weiss, both as far as liability and causation. So when we look at this inconsistent statement, we don't know if it was actually made, but we do know it was never considered and had no bearing on the issue for the police officer and in the police report. So with regards to that, the issue then became, too, whether or not that statement was going to be probative of any issue in the case. And the court has indicated talking about his felony conviction isn't going to make the accident more or less likely. It isn't going to make liability or causation more or less likely. It was clear that the issue there for the felony convictions was, when you look at the totality of the circumstances, I believe they understood how this case was going.
Well, your client also testified that actually he believed that Ms. Cortez had crossed the center line and hit the other vehicle head-on first before he hit her, and perhaps that's why her lights weren't on, and thereby causing him to run into the back of her. Wouldn't those felony convictions have the effect of allowing the jury to judge his credibility on that testimony?
With regards to that testimony was elicited by counsel for Ms. Cortez. Mr. Weiss was asked for his opinion on what he thought happened, and he indicated upon reflection that's what he believed, how the accident occurred. Now, in contrast to that, we've already talked about the police officer, but you also had the passengers in Ms. Cortez's vehicle, as well as Ms. Cortez, stating that they felt the impact from the rear first before they felt the head-on collision. We didn't hear from the other driver, the third vehicle involved. There was no evidence presented about that driver's version of the accident. So the fact that he's asked for his opinion on how the accident occurred, and that was the only place I believe that that opinion was elicited or given. It wasn't a major factor in the defense. It wasn't something that the case was built around. It was a one-time response to a question that was elicited from him regarding his opinion on how the accident occurred. Again, looking at the totality of the evidence that had already come into play, it was very minute, it was very small, it was very minor. Looking at Ms. Cortez's testimony, I believe one of the biggest problems was the inconsistency that she showed at trial. The fact that she couldn't remember when her day started. She couldn't remember when she went to the apartment. She was out till 2 a.m. It was elicited that in interrogatory she had said she had consumed no alcohol, yet at trial she said she had a sip of beer. She agreed that that was not true when she answered the interrogatories. In interrogatory, she said she was stopped at a red light waiting to make a left turn. At trial, it was brought out that was not true. There was no light. There wasn't even a dedicated turn lane there. There was the issue of alcohol being tossed out after the accident, where Ms. Cortez says, I didn't even know my passengers had beer until they were telling me to throw it out after the accident. I think these issues in Ms. Cortez's testimony, the inconsistencies, impacted the case more than the one statement by Mr. Weiss that he believed the impact with the head-on vehicle occurred first, causing her lights to be damaged, therefore he was unable to see her as he approached her on the hill. You also had testimony from the police officer. Now, while he indicated his investigation and his conclusions, there were issues with the police officer. You know, the officer had only been on his own for 30 to 60 days. He didn't measure skid marks. There were certain things he did not do, but he did reach his conclusion indicating he spoke to the passengers both in the third vehicle and in Ms. Cortez's vehicle. So that one statement by Mr. Weiss, again, looking at the totality of the circumstances, the totality of the evidence that was presented to the jury, is really, I think, made no role, but at very best, a minimal role. I think the jury had ample evidence from all the other witnesses and everything that would transpire that was presented to them to make a decision based on the facts and the evidence concerning this accident. And so at this point, to bring out this felony conviction that was almost 10 years old. These incidents happened in 2002, and this accident happened in 2009 and was being tried in 2011.
Oh, but the 10 years starts from when you were released, and he wasn't released after his parole revocation until sometime after 2009, so that's really not a valid issue.
Well, and I dispute that because when I thought about it, I saw that in the trial record, but the accident happened in 2009. If he was in jail, how would the accident have happened while he was in jail? That didn't make sense. And I thought there was some inconsistency whether we had the true story and whether we had all the evidence regarding these felony convictions and exactly how much time he was incarcerated. Because I saw that he was supposedly in jail for 8 years, which would have put him beyond the January 2009 when this accident occurred.
Not if he was released on parole and then his parole was revoked sometime in 2009 and he got out again in 2009. I mean,
But those are all assumptions that there was no evidence presented to that. What was presented were the three felony convictions, the documents, but there was no evidence with regards to exactly how much time he was incarcerated or what punishment he received. I know there were 4 years to run consecutively, but there was nothing in terms of testimony. So again, we were getting into an area that was going to be a little speculative, was going to call for some assumptions on everyone's part. And again, looking at the totality of this case, everything that came in, the live testimony, Ms. Cortez, Mr. Weiss, who was very consistent in his testimony, knew when his day started, what he had done, how long it took him to do things, and how the accident occurred. He was very forthcoming when he talked about Ms. Weiss's vehicle, or I'm sorry, Ms. Cortez, where he initially believed that was the vehicle that had passed him. He comes back and says, I was wrong. I was confused. It was not her. At trial, he was unequivocal. It was not her vehicle. So there was nothing to impeach him about. I cited the court to the case, the USA Machinery case, which is out of the Houston Court of Appeals, First District, where it was very similar. You had an individual who testified that he was working and living at home with his parents when, in fact, he had been incarcerated during some of that period. That was elicited during trial, and on cross-examination, they got him to admit that that was not correct. The trial court did not allow his felony convictions to come in. The Court of Appeals in Houston agreed and said, you cured any problem you had on cross-examination. There was no harm with regards to that testimony. I think we had even less here, because there was no need to clear anything up. He was very forthcoming with the fact that he was wrong. And so in this situation, I think it's even stronger than that. And I believe that to allow that information in would have been prejudicial. Again, this the second aspect of this, not only do we deal with abuse of discretion, which it is our position there wasn't. I believe the trial judge acted reasonably. He wasn't unreasonable or arbitrary, nor did he fail to follow any guiding principles or rules. He laid out exactly what he was discussing, what he was considering. The second aspect is that the whole case had to turn on the exclusion of this evidence, which I don't believe it did. And I don't believe there's any evidence that it did. I think the evidence is just the opposite. As we've discussed, there was ample evidence from the investigating officer, the police report, Ms. Cortez, photographs of the vehicle, the passenger statements through Officer Smith. Weiss admits that he rear-ended her. You've got the citation that he agrees that he received and pled guilty to. More than enough evidence to deal with this issue, so that simply not allowing three felony convictions of Mr. Weiss, I believe, did not control the judgment in this case. It did not result in an improper verdict.
Mr. Arias? Mr. Johnson, rebuttal?
Please, the court.
I think the alleged remoteness of the felony convictions is important, as counsel brought up in his argument, that he was saying it was almost 10 years ago, and of course we were never allowed to explore this issue at trial, but a offer of proof was made that Mr. Weiss testified at his deposition that he was sentenced to 8 years. In all likelihood, that did involve parole revocation, and whether or not there were other convictions or something is not in this record, but he did testify 8 years. And it's a 2003 conviction, and the so it's a January of 2009 accident. So certainly there was not a long time for rehabilitation. Some of the cases cited, just the Landry versus Travelers Insurance was cited by Eppley, where Mr. Landry had a workers' comp case where he claimed he had had a back injury, and he had a 1964 conviction for forgery and theft, and this comp trial was in 1968, and the Texas Supreme Court essentially said that that was too remote, and the dissent, I thought, in that case kind of got it right, showing that he was on parole at least until 1967, 1 year prior to the time that the trial actually occurred in that workers' comp case. So there was no period of rehabilitation or a good record, so to speak. And the same is true here with Mr. Weiss. He got out of prison sometime, apparently shortly before this accident occurred. It would have been helpful for the jury to hear about his convictions. Now, there were three, the evidence was, in this case, was that there were three officers who investigated. Officer Smith is the one officer who testified, and he was just out of training and apparently was assisted by the other officers in investigating the accident, so he himself did not talk to each witness or participant or victim in the accident. Therefore, there were some gaps, I would say, in the evidence. So because of that, Mr. Wash's and Ms. Cortez's testimony was even more important. The jury, I believe, Justice, your question about Mr. Wash's testimony that the second accident, the other accident occurred first, is significant, would have been helpful to the jury. These convictions would have been helpful to the jury in evaluating whether or not Mr. Wash was telling the truth.
But the rule that we're trying to apply here says that the probative value of admitting the evidence outweighs the prejudicial effect. And I think we've all sat here and agreed that it has a prejudicial effect and that it may have some probative value. But the harder that you argue, how important it was to get it in, sounds like to me the more prejudicial that it is, so the harder it becomes.
It is favorable to my client.
Sure, you're a good lawyer. You want to use all the errors in your quibble. I totally understand.
And somewhat prejudicial to Mr. White. But is that is it so prejudicial? And is it some offense that's so abhorrent that the jury would recoil and say, whatever Mr. White is accused of, he must be guilty because this is so prejudicial? It's, you know, it's a felony convictions that are evading arrest, not moral turpitude, but not respecting the police, not respecting the law.
But that's not really the standard. The standard is that the trial court abused its discretion, and if so, was there harm? Not could something else be more prejudicial. That's really not what we're supposed to look at. And if you as trial counsel asking Mr. White, well, what's your version of what happened, allows you to bootstrap in the convictions, I don't think that's what the case law allows either, is it?
Well, no, I mean, not just for that, but the case law, our rules of evidence permit those convictions if they're not too remote, and if the probative value outweighs the prejudicial effect. I believe they would have been probative if permitted, and would have resulted in a different result. Thank you very much.
Counsel, thank you so much for your argument here today. We really appreciate them. They've been helpful to the court. We also appreciate you traveling with us today, the Texas Western University School of Law. Your case is submitted. You are free to go about your business, and we will move on to our second question.
Never mind your disability, and it's lagging not being able to hear, get through high school, could be a very daunting task in some schools, isn't it?
Let me be the devil's advocate, believe lawyers, judges, high school students, and drivers of cars should be responsible and take responsibility for their own actions. And here we have a situation where your client, hearing impaired, and is responsible for seeing that at least one of the hearing aids is working. He's also responsible for articulating to the officer if he doesn't understand something that he doesn't understand. And so the bottom line here, being the devil's advocate, is that your client is not taking responsibility for his own actions, which led to your contention that he did not understand the warnings that he was giving.
The answer to that is simple. Again, Mr. Jones is a symptom of his disimpairment and his disability is that he does not want to be viewed as being less than anyone else.
And then should not take responsibility for that.
Well, you are going to show the same person who thinks that symptom of their disease, no, they should not be held responsible for that. If they're
if that's the symptom of his disease, when he was doing the heel to toe test, he asked numerous questions to make sure he got it right. Did he have the right foot in front of the
left foot? Is that where he was supposed to start? Is that the first step? Because he was supposed to step seven times. He was supposed to turn to the left. He stopped and he asked if he was turning the right way. He asked numerous questions during the course of the administration of that test. So thereby not exhibiting the symptoms of his disease that you're talking about.
However, that is again, if you look at his shoulders, he didn't understand what the officer was doing and was trying to master it. However, he got to the point where he didn't know what to do, and he was lost. He had to drop that mask and ask questions. I think that goes to the fact that he is a disabled person and that he didn't understand.
Well, he really wasn't lost. He just asked if starting out was considered the first step or not. That's not really being lost, is it?
Not understanding that what he's supposed to do it. And on the provision as well, they gave him written notes. The ADA rules and regulations provide that although some circumstances, written notes may be sufficient to prevent effective communication, in many instances, they may not be. For example, a qualified interpreter may be necessary when the information being communicated is complex or is exchanged for a lengthy period of time. Factors to consider include the context in which the communication is taking place, the number of people involved, and the importance of the communication. Again, the EI 624, basically read rather quickly through, somebody who's never heard before. If you look, and this court has seen other cases, the officers have problems reading that thing. It is so hard. And they follow through. They're not intoxicated, but they follow through and they can't say those words. So I suggest that the DIC 24 qualifies for that type of complicated and complex information being conveyed. The fact that you're under arrest, I'm close to that situation a couple of times myself. It's a very telling and very debilitating act, Judge McBride.
Okay,
I didn't think it.
Unless you have any further questions.